Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's program is co-sponsored by the law firm of Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman, and the San Francisco Business Times. I'm Greg Dalton, the Commonwealth Club Chief Operating Officer. I also welcome our listeners on the radio and on television, and we invite everyone to visit us on commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest. Sandy Weill is one of the true giants of Wall Street. In his 5 decades on the street, Mr. Weill initiated a bold streak of acquisitions that culminated in the $83 billion merger between Citicorp and Travelers. The deal created Citigroup, a global financial powerhouse in banking, asset management, insurance, and brokerage. At the time, it was the largest corporate merger in history. After growing up in Brooklyn during the Depression era, Mr. Weill started in the brokerage business as a runner earning $150 a month. At the age of 27 in 1960, he launched his own company when his mother loaned him $30,000, about all she had at that time. Over the next 20 years, he and his partner steadily built their brokerage and asset management firm. In 1981, he sold the company, then named Shearson, to American Express for $1 billion. Disillusioned with an empty title as president of Shearson and his lack of authority, he resigned from Amex in 1985. He went on to build another company, and in 1993, he bought back his pride and joy, Shearson, from American Express. Soon after, he acquired Travelers Insurance. And in 1998, he pulled off his crowning achievement, which was merging Travelers with Citicorp. In 2003, his handpicked successor, Chuck Prince, took over as Citigroup CEO. And earlier this year, Mr. Weill stepped aside as chairman. Along the way, Mr. Weill also was a leader in the philanthropic community. He served as chairman of Carnegie Hall, which, during his leadership, increased its endowment from $2 million to $250 million. Mr. Weill's 70th birthday party raised $60 million for Carnegie's Music Education Endowment, a record for fundraising in a single evening. I think our invitations got lost on that one. What an event. What a party. He also serves as chairman of the Board of Overseers for the Joan and Sanford Weill Medical College of Cornell University and is chair of the National Academy Foundation, which prepares inner-city high school students for careers in financial services and other industries. He recently penned his memoirs titled The Real Deal, My Life in Business and Philanthropy. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Sandy Weill. Most mergers, research shows that most mergers fail to live up to their expectations. You know, studies by McKinsey and others have shown that many mergers don't do what they expect to do. You led a number of acquisitions, most successful, some not. So what do you look for in a merger, and why do you think that so many don't meet expectations?
Well, I think that really somebody should know what they're doing when they think about a merger. Mergers don't happen in minutes. There are things that really develop in relationships with other companies over many, many years, sometimes over decades. And when a company does do a merger, they should be prepared to make the difficult decisions. You have to decide, especially if it's a merger with companies in the same business, who is the best person to run this or that or the other thing, no matter what part of the company, whether they came from the company doing the buying or the company being sold, because the people close to the customer know who the better person is. And if you don't make those decisions, the good people will leave and you'll be left with a bunch of losers. And basically, if you don't do mergers well and you don't treat the acquired company properly and the people that are selling properly, you're going to get a reputation and you won't be able to do any more mergers. So if one wants to grow organically plus with mergers, I think you have to do them right. And I would say that the great, great preponderance of the things that we did, we executed very well on, because we had good back offices, good people, we had a partnership, and we knew what we were doing.
You write about cultural fit, and sometimes there's cultural fit and sometimes there isn't. How do you evaluate culture before you take over a company? And how do you assess whether, you know, a white shoe firm is going to fit well with a different type of a financial firm?
Well, you know, I think in a lot of the brokerage companies that we bought, which goes back into the growth of our company in the 70s, the one that we sold to American Express, a lot of companies in that business didn't know how to run their operation and were having problems. And the people that worked at those companies were looking for a company that had a good balance sheet, that knew how to run a business, that could be profitable, that their customers would feel safe leaving their securities with. So it was pretty easy to think through that. In my second career, starting with Commercial Credit, which was a small loan company in Baltimore making $25 million in 1986. We grew that a step at a time, and as we went along, what we were able to do sort of led to the next thing. And, you know, the big, big opportunity that we had was buying a company called Primerica, the old American Can, that was in the securities business and was in the insurance business, wasn't a lot of financial businesses that had a very tough time through the market crash of 1987. And we were able to buy that, which gave us the opportunity to expand and build really a significant financial company, basically at that time headquartered in the U.S.
One of your earliest employers and mentors was Tubby Burnham. What did you learn from him that helped you in your career?
I think Tubby Burnham was a phenomenal person. He might not have been the smartest guy in the world, and I'm not sure how important that is, because I think it's important to hire people smarter than you are. But he had a lot of common sense. He related to his employees. He walked around. Everybody knew him. The people in the company looked at it as a family business. I was there to celebrate their 25th anniversary, and I always thought that if I ever started a business, God, if we could ever be in business for 25 years, it would be a phenomenal thing. And, you know, that happened in the company that we started in 1960. In 1985, as part of American Express, was our 25th anniversary. And 2 years after that anniversary party at the U.S. Treasury building downtown, I decided to leave and think about what I want to do with the rest of my life.
And you also mentored a number of other people in your career, most notably Peter Cohen and Jamie Dimon. During the years, Peter served as a buffer between you and the staff, and later Jamie was your right-hand man at Smith Barney. And yet in later times, those relationships became strained. And you mentioned that it happened around the time that their biological clocks kicked in around 40. I'm interested in what you meant by that and what you learned from, mm-hmm. from the other side, being a mentor.
Yeah, well, both of them were really very, very smart, and they both were very helpful to me. I had very close relationships with both of them, but they wanted more responsibility, and I gave them both more responsibility. But I was still young at the point in time that they were working for me, much, much younger when Peter was there, but not ready to retire when Jamie was there either. Since I wasn't ready to leave, they had to slow down their ideas of growth. And, you know, when I was not made privy to what was going on in the company, and yet I was still the CEO and responsible for everything that would happen, even though they had the authority in particular areas, it created, unfortunately, a problem, and I feel sad about it.
You in touch with them now, or have you?
Well, I didn't speak to Peter for about 15 or 20 years, but going through the process of writing this book with Judah, I really came to the conclusion that grudges shouldn't be forever. One doesn't live forever, and there's time to forget that. There were a lot of good parts of the relationship, and let's get on with our lives and let's recreate relationships. So the answer is yes.
And I think, what, Jamie, is he now running JP?
Jamie is running JP Morgan, right?
Is there really...
And I finally figured out a way to do a succession with him. I was on the board of the New York Fed for the past a little over five years, and I'm retiring from that in December, and Jamie is going to be taking my place on that board come January 2nd, so we've worked out some form of a succession planning.
Good to hear. Is there really such a thing as a merger of equals in corporate America? Some deals are often positioned as a merger, but are actually acquisitions. Daimler took over Chrysler, Nations Bank took over Bank of America, Dean Witter, Morgan Stanley. Is there really such a thing as a merger of equals, or are they veiled acquisitions?
Well, you know, I think you're referring to the merger of Travelers and Citicorp, which we described as a merger of equals. And when you looked at those two companies, they had both done incredibly well through the decade of the 90s until 1998. Both companies earned about $3.5 billion after taxes. Both companies had about $20 billion in equity. So they really were equal from a financial point of view. If you looked at Citicorp, it had businesses all around the world. I noticed that the Commonwealth Club was founded in 1903, and I happen to remember that year because I was in Asia celebrating the 100th anniversary of in 2003 of Citibank in Japan, in India, opening in Shanghai. We left there temporarily because we weren't quite up to the Cultural Revolution, but came back in the second part of the 80s, I think 87. And here were two companies. One had just about all the financial products, that was Travelers, and the other had tremendous global distribution, that was Citicorp. And if you put them together, we would have a company with the biggest equity of anybody in the financial business. This is 1998, $40 billion. So if there were problems with countries, or there was another problem like the Asian crisis, and it happened soon after we announced our merger that Russia went broke, which created lots of problems, and long-term capital had issues, we would be able to withstand that and be able to look toward a problem as an opportunity to grow when other companies might be hit with those problems. We had a company that, when we put it together, made $7 billion. Its income was diversified over all continents. So it was really a terrific thing. And you look from 1998 to 2006, the company now, the equity has grown from $40 billion to $115 billion. The profits have tripled from about $7 billion to the last quarter annualized over $21 billion. And we have important positions all around the world, which I think is great for the United States in having a U.S.-based company that can lead the development of opportunity for middle class and people in these emerging market countries so they can see a life and a value in this world rather than no opportunity in this world, and they're prone to somebody taking them for a walk up a mountain and saying there's a better life in the next world and come down and blow themselves up along with a lot of other people. So that merger of equals was good for the development of the company. It was not great for a lot of the key people in the company because John and I became co-chairmen. Our management styles were very different. We could probably still be together working in whatever funny way we did, but we wouldn't have anybody working for us because we drove them all crazy, and so that's one of the problems.
One of my one of the line in the book is that you're talking about this with your wife, who tells you, Sandy, you're not the best at sharing, and she was wondering about this co-CEO. And in fact, it's very rare in corporate America to have a successful co-CEO situation. I think Charles Schwab and David Pottruck did it for a while. That no longer
not
exists.
Not that well, right?
Yeah. So
he used to work for me, David Pottruck. So
okay.
I'm, right?
So I'm interested in how you thought you could make something work that is so difficult for anywhere else, in other individuals and other corporations.
Well, I so much wanted to do this transaction, and I knew that, you know, Citicorp had talked to American Express before we spoke to them. And I felt, not knowing facts, but I felt and still feel that that didn't happen because of talks about who would run the combined company when, that I felt John and I had a good enough career that we should be mature enough to do it. I'll give you an example where co-something worked. For a little over 2 years, Judah and I worked on this book as co-authors. We had a wonderful time together. We're still very friendly. We're hoping everybody here wants to buy a copy of the book because we like sales.
I will say we have a lot of people through the Commonwealth Club who write books, and this is the first time I can remember where a co-author has come along with the, pardon me, more famous author. So you mentioned the stock performance, some of the increased earnings, et cetera, of the company, though the stock's around 50 today. I think 5 years ago it was also around 50. Some other companies, Viacom, for example, that have been conglomerates have divested themselves to sort of unlock the value in the acquisitions. Daimler's thinking about selling Chrysler. Can you envision a scenario when Citicorp might have to sell some things to unlock some of the mm-hmm. value?
Well, I don't think it should have to sell something to unlock value. I think the world is always changing, and Citigroup should look at how the financial industry is changing and figure out how they should react to that. I think one major change that has taken place over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years is we've gone to, in the products that we market to our customers, to open architecture, where we want to offer our customers the best possible products, no matter who manufactures them. The profit has moved toward the distributor and away from the manufacturer. So, you know, so that changed, and because of that, we. You know, sold certain manufacturing parts of our business, but I think the basic concept of what made sense in the creation of this company and its position that it has in both the consumer and the corporate business in lots of countries where we can collect deposits and make loans and not have the problem of cross-border exposure really makes sense. And I think the company is postured in a terrific way for the future. Let me just say also that in my first career at Shearson, which went public in 1971, and through the time that I left in about 1985, that company grew at about 25% a year in not a very good market environment. And from the time we started again with commercial credit at the end of 1986 till 2003, when I retired, that company stock grew over 25% a year. So you're looking at a company that grew over 25% a year for shareholders for 30 years, a heck of a lot better than what Warren Buffett did in that same period of time, and GE and AIG, and you pick it.
I just have those cards right here, 2,600% compounded for Citigroup from 86 to 2003. 2,500% for Berkshire Hathaway and less for GE. So
much less for GE.
And last year we had a guy speak here at the club called Jack Welch. You heard of him?
I have.
You play golf with him?
I have, as a matter of fact.
Who wins?
Pardon me?
Who wins?
He was a better golfer. But
but by these numbers, you're a better investor. Why do you think, do you think the media plays favorites? These are two fabled, iconic investors, and yet these returns are better for you for that period. Why isn't that better known?
Well, I think it was better for all the people that owned our stock. Yeah, you know, well, they're very happy.
I asked, why isn't it better known? Why don't more people know that?
I really don't know, but the facts are the facts. And,
well, after this interview and the tour, people will know.
So. Right, that's good. But it's too late. I'm retired.
So they're catching up on you. You started as a runner on the exchange and later became a broker. You still have a strong connection with traders and brokers. Do you think that exchanges will continue to have specialists and these kinds of people, or will exchanges become fully automated and like NASDAQ?
I think they're going to become much more automated. I think that the New York Stock Exchange is in a position of migrating. I think they're going to become much more global, like the New York Stock Exchange is now talking to Euronext and thinking about creating something that would take into account both the Euro market and the U.S. market. The London Stock Exchange is talking to the Tokyo Stock Exchange. There are going to be a lot of consolidations in that business to make the business more efficient, to make it cheaper delivery of what the consumers want, and give people much more exposure to the growth that is happening really all around the world.
It used to be that investors, even foreign companies, came to U.S. capital markets to raise big issues, though this year the two largest IPOs are in Hong Kong, two Chinese mainland companies. Do you think the U.S. is going to see more and more of other capital markets getting the big issues, the big sexy issues?
Well, I think what's happened with that to some extent is Sarbanes-Oxley, which was a result of the problems that happened in the securities business with the breaking down of Chinese walls and some of the frauds that took place. When that happens, that's bad on one side. You have regulation that overreacts sometimes on the other side. And Sarbanes-Oxley was important regulation to have. But then I think we come to a period of time where we recognize that we're correcting some of the problems of the past, and yet the correction maybe went too far, and it should come back to a neutral level. And I think really that's what we're seeing right now with people like John Thane, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, and the head of the SEC, and recently the Democrat in the House, who probably will be head of the House Finance Committee, saying that they'd rather see the House focus on CEO compensation and ease up somewhat on Sarbanes-Oxley, which have made the reporting requirements a little more onerous than it would be in Hong Kong or London, which has led a lot of these issues to be outside the United States. And since this country really has been, should be, and hopefully will be, the leader in the financial markets all over the world, we have to have the regulations have to be good, but it has to be competitive with what's happening in the rest of the world. And I think you will see us move there in the next 12 months.
Any specific ideas what exactly about Sarbox might be relaxed?
Well, I think that a lot of the reporting requirements put some burdens, on companies. And I would say to you that since I'm retired, I really don't focus on that much anymore. But I know what you know, and I know what I read in the paper, and when people are complaining about it. And I go to sleep now on Sunday nights for the first time in 50 years because I'm really not worried about Sawbox.
Though you do write favorably about the fact that CEOs and CFOs have to sign to personally sign, testify to,
right.
You think that'll stay?
Probably.
You write, as a lender and financial insider, you expressed frustration with the opaque world of hedge funds and said something to the effect, if we can't understand what they're doing, how can we lend to these institutions? Do you think that the veil should be lifted on hedge funds, and if so, how and by whom?
I think that I was probably writing that as it related to what happened in 1998 with long-term capital and with some of the hedge funds that had a lot of ruble investments because those were much higher returns, and they ended up creating liquidity by selling out everything and ending up just as an investor in Russian securities, which created a problem. What I really do believe is that with all the creation of these sophisticated new financial instruments and derivatives, there should be one intelligent regulator that can collect the information that is happening in not just the banking industry, which the Fed does now, but the securities industry, which also is as big as the banking industry is today in derivatives in these transactions, as well as the hedge funds that have become a very big factor in the marketplace, so that when we are looking at what's happening, we know that there's a regulator that has all of the information at their disposal, which I think is a very, very important thing in creating the safety and soundness of the markets, and hopefully we move toward that.
Greater consolidation of regulatory oversight. Okay. During the negotiations you had with Bank of America and Deutsche Bank, word of those talks were leaked to the press, possibly by a board member. How did you respond to those leaks, and what, if anything, did you do to try to stop those leaks from the boardroom?
It's a pointed question, huh?
Oh, I have more points.
But that's your right. Let me say that when we had our conversations with between Travelers and Citicorp, nothing leaked. It was the biggest financial transaction that had taken place in any industry up to that time. And it was when we announced it on a Monday morning, and I even told it to President Clinton on Sunday night, the night before, and said, listen, Mr. President, this is inside information, but this is going to happen. I think it'd be great for the financial industry and great for the country. Nobody knew, and our stocks went up $18 billion that next day because people really reacted to it well. I think things get leaked because people have different agendas, and that in the conversation so that we had with Deutsche Bank, there were people on their supervisory board that were not anxious for this thing to happen. There were people in Germany that maybe felt that it wasn't the best thing for Germany to be the second headquarters of the best financial institution in the world, rather than to be the first headquarters of somebody that, you know, was still at that time struggling. The company subsequently done very well, and the same thing with Bank of America. You know, that was leaked to the press. This is going back a long way, like 1985, end of 85, beginning of 86, was when I had conversations with Bank of America. That was a tough time out here, as a lot of you would remember. I think when things leak in our company from the board, and they do from time to time, we remind board members that they are doing a disservice to their fellow directors. They are probably also doing a disservice to themselves, and what happens in that boardroom should be private and shouldn't be leaked to anybody. And but we never felt that it was appropriate to do an investigation. We never felt that we really could find out who did what. So basically, we just used peer pressure to try and stop the problems, which did stop, by the way.
New York Attorney General...
How's that for a safe answer?
Terrific. Right. We didn't bug the... Yeah. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer pursued many areas of the financial industry, investment banking and research, mutual funds, insurance, and stock options. And shareholder advocates contend that the markets are more transparent, more trustworthy due to his work. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I think that's probably true. I think he was very smart. He raised issues that had grown into problems, and I think that from the issues that were raised, the markets probably are better than they were. I think some of the solutions or suggestions really haven't worked that well in some areas, like in insurance, where they've gone back to what they were doing before some of the investigations. I think securities companies having independent research hasn't been a big success and a big help to the investing public. But the fact that research is completely independent from banking, I think, has raised the quality of the research product that people can depend upon. And the fact that there are many more sales recommendations than there used to be and not everything is a buy has also been a good thing. I think one of the problems in some of those investigations were the leaks of what was confidential and going on to the press as that was happening, rather than the investigations taking place. But I think he basically exposed some issues that should have been exposed, and the industry is better off because of it.
By the time our radio listeners hear this and our TV viewers, Eliot Spitzer may be the governor of New York. Are you going to send him a note?
I'd say that'd be a good bet.
You going to call him and send him a bottle of champagne?
Well, he'd probably send me a check to pay for the champagne.
Yeah. Or at least ask you where you bought it or who paid for it.
Right.
This is one from the audience, which asks, would you please comment on service industry jobs, particularly in the banking industry, being outsourced, and whether there are security concerns? And I think this means security with respect to individual privacy rather than national security.
I think you're right. And let me say that I think that, by and large, the jobs that are being outsourced from financial services companies are basically jobs that Americans don't want to have and don't really like. And a lot of that relates to call centers, where people get burned out pretty fast. The turnover in call centers in the United States are multiples higher than what they are in other countries, where there aren't as many opportunities for people. So I think while we outsource some things, we also insource a lot of jobs here. And the employment in the services businesses and in the financial services industry in particular has grown dramatically in the United States over the period. As far as security, I think that companies in the industry are doing more and more to protect the privacy and the personal information of people. And I think basically you can count on it. Once every now and then there's going to be somebody that figures out how to get through the system, and there's going to be a breakdown. But I think that's going to be much, much more the exception than the rule.
Early in your career, you were a partner with Arthur Levitt. I think he left in the 70s to chair the American Stocks Exchange.
In 78.
And
not that I remember.
I think you said he was he came to you as selling cattle as tax shelters, if that's correct.
That's true.
And he later. So, how do you think he did as a regulator in terms? He was known as being a shareholder advocate. How would you assess his record as a regulator?
I think Arthur cared a heck of a lot for the individual investor, and I think that pretty much everything that you saw in the 8 years that he was the head of the SEC was consistent with the fact that he wanted the markets to be better for the individual investor. Having said that, there are a lot of issues that happened in that period of time that subsequently had to be addressed. But I'd say, by and large, I would personally give Arthur pretty good marks for what he did in that period.
One from our audience: how consolidated do you think the financial industry sector will become? Do you see only a few major banks? Which ones will survive?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there'll be much more than a few, but I think the financial industry, like a lot of other businesses, Consolidation will continue to take place. When you're in an industry that your products are not unique and other people make those products, you have to be very good, you have to end up being the lowest cost producer of quality products. And that's going to mean that there are going to be more in-country mergers as well as cross-border mergers. But the financial industry is a place that always has room for entrepreneurs and the creation of new businesses and specialty businesses. And we've seen a lot of those develop over the last 10 years and really over the last 50 years. I was an example of that 45 years ago. So I think you'll see both. I think you'll see consolidation, and I think you'll see new development. But it won't be down to just a few.
Do you think investment banks like Goldman and Lehman can continue without a commercial banking partner? Why do you think that other commercial investment banks have not copied the Citi model?
I think our model is so good that on a personal opinion basis, I would guess that over the next 5 or 10 years, you will see Goldman and Lehman think about and possibly do something in that direction. What they've done is they've gone into the lending business without becoming a bank. So they're competing with us all the time on corporate loans and with buyout companies and funding what they do in the private equity world.
Regarding recent changes in the bankruptcy laws, do you think that the interests of the financial industry came out better than the interests of the individual consumer?
I think that with the change in the bankruptcy law and the fact that everybody had a year's advance notice before the law would change, it appeared if one were in the financial business, that just about everybody that would want to go bankrupt went bankrupt before September of 2005. So that for the last year, the bankruptcies have declined a lot because most everybody took advantage of what was maybe too favorable environment before that. And I think you're going to begin to see it begin to come back a little bit. But basically, I think the more important thing is I think the financial consumer in the United States is in very good shape. The amount of their income that's spent on debt service is about 17%, not an incredibly high number. They've paid down a lot of high interest loans on credit cards and other things through taking out or refinancing mortgages on their house. And even with interest rates where they are today, mortgage rates are still, very, very low historically, maybe 30 basis points above 6%. So that the consumer is in good shape. And if we can get more of the risk premium out of the price of oil, I think the consumer will be even better shape. The price of oil at the pump has gone down about 25% since the beginning of August. In a state like California, where everybody is really so dependent on the cars and gasoline prices, that's an important thing, which will give the American consumer the ability to spend that money on other kinds of things that they want.
You mentioned that consumers are in good shape, and yet many economists would argue that the United States doesn't save enough, that other countries, Japan, China, others save a lot more, and that we are sort of leveraged to the gills, and that's a concern to macroeconomists. Would you agree with that?
I'm so glad you asked that. No, I don't agree with it at all, and I'll tell you why I don't agree with it. I think that the way we figure savings in this country really doesn't relate to what people do. Basically, the savings rate in the United States has no bearing whatsoever on the value of one's investments, any change in the value of one's 401k. The market has more than recovered fully from where it got to in the year 2000. It doesn't take into account the increased value in housing, which over the last 20 years has been enormous. So when anybody in this room thinks about, do you feel comfortable, you're going to look at what your assets are, you know, which is on a complete basis. It's not just what your income is from your salary, but it's what the dividends are, it's what the value of your securities are, it's what the value of your equity in your house is. And if that number is very big and your debt is very small compared to that, you're going to feel comfortable. So the way I figure, Americans are saving a lot. Their net worth has never been higher. I think that the way we report it is a very, very narrow way to look at what somebody is worth and how that worth is going to impact what they do and spend and what they can afford to spend.
Does that mean to say you don't think the government needs to do more to encourage retirement savings, restructure the 401k plan, or have other inducements to increase retirement savings, possibly as part of restructuring Social Security?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. I think that the more encouragement that our government can do to create incentives for people to save more through 401ks, to diversify in those 401ks, and plan for your own retirement rather than just counting on Social Security, I think the better we'll be. And, you know, Social Security is just a fixed income part of the thing, and it doesn't hold a candle to what has been the rate of growth of one's value in their house, even though that's stabilized here or gone down a little bit for the last few months. If you look back on the last 10 years or 20 years, it's an enormous number rather than the few percent a year that the Social Security builds up the value. And the same thing is true in the equity markets, where the stock market went from 800 in 1982 to a little over 10,000. In the year 2000. That's double-digit returns. That's different than what the government talks about. So I'm not an economist, and basically I think I disagree with those that look at it that way, and I have that argument over and over with a lot of people much smarter than I am.
Corporate America seems to have a lot of cash on the sidelines. Would shareholders be better served if that cash was invested in infrastructure, or do you believe corporate buybacks add more value?
Well, you know, I think what I believe the most is that the government's reduction of the tax on dividends was a terrific thing for the individual investor. I think it really empowered the investor because that money was able to be paid out to people. And they only had to pay a 15% tax on it. So what the companies are saying by paying out more in the way of dividends is, hey, investor, we're going to give you that money. You can decide whether you're going to put the money back in owning more stock in this company, buy some stock in another company, or spend that money. And empowering the investor to determine based on the different returns. So personally, I think that dividends are, especially if they're not taxed completely in a double taxation way, are more important than stock buybacks.
And an economist recently spoke to the Commonwealth Club, I think this was last year, who talked about the reduction in taxes on capital gains and dividends and said that the taxes on capital are going down, but the taxes on labor, people's wages, are remaining the same, so that increasingly those who work rather through their own labor versus put their capital to work are bearing more of the tax burden. Do you think that's a reasonable assessment?
No. Because, you know, somebody works and they pay whatever the taxes is on the money that they earn. They spend some of that money. They have some of that money left over for investment. And there's no reason why that investment money should be taxed at the same rate that you paid to save the money in the first place. And if you look around at countries all over the world, I don't think there's a country in the world that has the same tax rate on investments that they do on income. Right, honey? My wife agrees.
Well, there. Mm-hmm.
In 1980, the CEOs of S&P 500 companies made about 40 times the average worker. In 2005, those CEOs made about 400 times the average worker. A cover of Fortune magazine a while back had a cover of a Silicon Valley CEO with a cover line, the great CEO pay heist. There's a number of questions here about CEO compensation, whether it's at appropriate level, whether shareholders should have a role in setting CEO compensation. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think shareholders have some role in setting compensation, and that CEO compensation has to be approved by shareholders in some kind of general format. But let me tell you what I really think, which is a little different than the way you phrased the question. What I think is that we have to educate the people in our country better, in our high schools in this country. We have to have a much better graduation rate. We have to have a rate where people want to, that do graduate, want to go and have further education because they realize that education is excuse me, what's going to unlock the door to their financial future. That education really shows them the difference between an entry-level job and what they can accomplish. And I think it's I'm sorry for that, my coughing, but I think it is very important for us to bridge that gap between the haves and the have-nots, and I think that that's going to happen really through improving our education system. And I think that's a much better way than saying that you make 40 times as much or 400 times as much. I'm sure there are lots of CEOs and lots of people that are paid too much. But it's a competitive world, and there are lots of CEOs that lose their jobs faster than people also.
Do you think that CEO performance and compensation should be, CEO compensation should be linked to performance? And might there be ways in restructuring some of the compensation committees and the consultants that seem to be able to justify ever and ever higher rates?
I think that CEO compensation should be linked to performance. And I think that performance should be determined by how does a company do for its shareholders? What kind of environment does it create for the growth of the people that work in the company, and what kind of job is it doing for its customers? And if the CEO is doing a good job on those things and he's creating a company that is growing and attracting the best men and women from around the world, that CEO deserves to be paid. And if he's not doing that, he shouldn't be.
There's a question here from the audience about your bonus and compensation in light of the fact that after that Citibank paid, I guess, quite a large sum, billions of dollars for shareholder lawsuits. I think this was related to WorldCom, and right. Whether that ought to have any, that kind of activity ought to have any impact on a CEO's compensation.
Well, I think that that year it did have an impact on CEO compensation, but a big percentage of the compensation that I got, and if people are talking about me specifically, our company had a rule that all the stock that the senior management, this is like the top 100 people in the company, got in exercising stock options or in getting restricted stock, we couldn't sell any of that stock till we retired. So unlike what happened in most other companies where, you know, when an option vested, you'd sell that option and take the profit and buy a Ferrari or expand a house or a second house, we weren't allowed to do that at Citigroup. So we were forced to get rich because our company did very well for shareholders and none of us could sell the stock. We also had every single employee in our company got stock options. So the people that worked in our company thought about what is in the best interest of the company, how can we save money in what we're doing. The 401ks of our employees went up a lot. Most of the people were able to earn restricted stock at discounts to the market, so that we have more people that have had their lives changed, their kids being able to go to college, they're being able to think about retirement, they're being able to improve their standard of living, they're being able to become a philanthropist, happened because they worked for a company where they felt like an owner. And this is like tens and hundreds of thousands of people felt that way, not just in the United States, but around the world, and made this company into a great company whose stock went up 2,600 times.
There, you mentioned philanthropy. There's a question here about what role philanthropy...
And that's nothing to apologize for.
You mentioned philanthropy, and there's a question here about what role should philanthropy play within a Fortune 500 company?
I think philanthropy is a very, very important issue for companies. You know, basically, I think it's important for companies to not just rely on governments, but to get the people that are involved in the company involved in local institutions to improve the areas where they work, to work for some of the institutions that are going to make their communities better. And philanthropy is not just giving away money or some CEO's thinking that he's being a very good citizen by giving away shareholder money to this charity or that charity. But philanthropy is really, I think, about having a passion for something that you believe in, dedicating your energy, your time, what you've learned, your intelligence to making institutions in your community better and in doing what you can to try and make this world a better place. I'm the chairman of a medical school in New York that negotiated from 2000 to April 2001 with the Qatar Foundation in the Middle East to build a medical school there, which opened in 2001, and then we had 9/11, we had the Iraqi war, we've had a lot of issues, but we now are finished, we're in our fifth year of this medical school. It's a six-year program, 2 years pre-med, 4 years of medical school. It's co-ed classes in the Middle East. The students are doing as well academically as they are in New York. They love Americans. This is a way of bridging the gap between the Muslim community in that world and how they think of Americans, not just our government. And if we can get people to think about the similarities in the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, of which they're all very, very similar, and think about how we should be brothers rather than what are the bad things and fighting each other, this will be a much better place. And I think it's important for companies to think like that, especially when, you know, we're having problems where, you know, our government doesn't seem sometimes to act that way. This is something that's worthy for companies to do.
Does your philanthropic plan post-retirement include attention to global poverty in addition to your generous support of Cornell Medical and Carnegie Hall?
Well, you know, again, I think, you know, my medical school, which I'm chairman of and have been for 10 years, built a medical school in Qatar. Certainly that's not a poverty place. But we are developing a medical school in Bagondo, Tanzania, which has one doctor for every 30-some-odd thousand people, where the average life expectancy is 42 years, and that's not all because of the problem with AIDS. It's because of the lack of education in childbirth. It's because of the people not knowing how to take care of early childhood diseases and these young people dying at a very young age. And this is something where it's a public, it's a partnership of the government of Tanzania, the Catholic Church, which owns this institution, the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, and a not-for-profit organization called the Touch Foundation, which my wife is on the board of. And so I think the answer to that is yes. I believe very strongly that if we don't, and I said this before, if we don't show people around the world that there is an opportunity for them in this life where they can improve their life, where we do things that improve the standard of living, where people are educated and think they have a better chance, I'm not sure what the future of this world is going to be to our kids and our grandkids. And, you know, so I am doing everything I can in that area.
You mentioned kids and grandkids, and recently, previously talked about the disparity in wealth in this country. The Commonwealth Club had a speaker a couple of years ago, Bill Gates Sr., who was arguing quite passionately about retaining the inheritance tax. Do you think that that tax ought to remain or ought to be done away with, as many people suggest?
Well, my wife has convinced me that shrouds don't have pockets. So I know the alternative of taking it with me is not a good one. We've tried to convince our kids that they'd be better off doing it on their own. So, you know, that says who cares about the inheritance tax? We've said we're gonna try and give away most of our money. Hopefully, we'll have our health to do that in things that we really have a passion for and are gonna be involved in. Before we die, and it's why I think I really wanted to retire and spend you know, more time with a woman that I've been married to for 51 years that gave me the confidence in myself to really think okay about myself, and was enough of a risk taker to encourage us to put all our money in a business at a very young age. And later on in life, say to me, down boy, get real, you know, let's get this ego under control. And, you know, so.
So in, as I mentioned in the introduction, under your leadership, the Carnegie Hall has raised its endowment from $2 million to $250 million. And tell us a little bit about how you did that and how the organization changed and how you, that's quite a remarkable transformation for one of the nation's
musical icons. Well, it's a wonderful institution. And I think, and I always talk about never be afraid of hiring people smarter than you are. And I think when you think about the not-for-profit world, you want to be in business with people that really know the area that they're working in better than I would know, having been a businessman. So, you know, my background in music, and you talk about Carnegie Hall, was playing a bass drum in a military school band. My understanding of classical music was John Philip Sousa. But we've had really terrific, and have today, tremendous management at Carnegie Hall that, you know, I'm happy to support, that they have good ideas. We not just raised the endowment, but in that same period of time, we built a new hall downstairs, Zankel Hall, where we have all different types of music and reach out to broader audiences and younger people, which is very important. In the medical arena, we just finished a year ago a $750 million campaign to expand our clinical research and delivery of clinical services. And we just announced a week ago, after a one-year hiatus, a $1.3 billion campaign to expand and more than double our research facilities. That is the biggest campaign that we believe any medical school has ever had. In my National Academy Foundation, our high school program, we're in over 500 schools with 50,000 students. Last year, over 90% of them graduated. Over 80% of them went on to college. This is in inner cities where less than 50% graduated. We got a grant 6 months ago from the Gates Foundation, where I feel terrific about, because they really know a lot about reforming education, and we may have a model that can can do that, and we're now thinking about starting a school in engineering next year, because when you think about it, that's one of the growth markets as a career in the United States, and yet only 15% of all the engineers in the United States are women, and a very small percentage are from a diverse population. That's not what it should be. And so we want to marry the opportunities with the people and show these young people that they can do good things.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our speaker today is Sandy Weil, recently retired chairman of Citigroup, board chair of Carnegie Hall, and author of the memoir, The Real Deal. He's discussing his work in business and philanthropy. You mentioned women engineers. What did you do at Citigroup and your other companies to advance women beyond the perceived glass ceiling on Wall Street, as well as other minorities?
Well, as far as other minorities, I had the good fortune to work with Jesse Jackson in the start of the Wall Street Project, whose real focus was to create opportunities for African Americans and other minorities in the investment advisory business and in the financial business, and it's had some really good results so far. We've had in our company, when I was there, several women that were in the top 10 of the Fortune most powerful women list. But the most important thing is, I am completely controlled by two women. On one hand, I have my wife, who is my partner and my advisor. And on the other hand, I have my daughter, who is a great entrepreneur and has built a terrific company really from scratch that she took public 3 years ago, that's now listed on the New York Stock Exchange, has $1.5 billion market cap. So I'm a big fan of at least women in my family.
Other than those two, who do you admire most in the business world and the public arena? Who are the leaders out there that you find inspiring right now?
I'm looking for an answer to your question. Who do I find most inspiring? I don't want to just say anything. I think there are some inspirational people out there. This is a very confusing time. Well, let me get a hint from my wife. Who? Who?
Mandela.
Oh, Nelson Mandela. Yeah, right. I do. I mean, when my wife and I happened to meet Nelson Mandela down in South Africa about 2 years ago, and you knew that you were in the presence of a unique person. I met Dr. DeBakey, who was one of the first people to do these heart transplants in Texas and at the Texas Medical Center, 96 years old, tremendous presence, remembers everything. I knew I was in the presence of another really unique person, so I've been blessed to meet people like that.
Terrific. We've come to the point where we have time for one last question, and this is from the audience and is something that's on a lot of people's mind these days. Recently, the British government issued an economic report on possible future impact of climate change. How do you think CEOs should respond to the report and its potential economic effects on global capitalism?
Well, I think that it's very important that companies and CEOs be good citizens of the world. I think we should study all the facts and statistics that really become available and not just be panicked by this report or that report, but think what is really the appropriate thing to do and act as somebody that is concerned about the environment, is concerned about what this world is going to be like from a physical point of view 50 and 100 and 200 years from now, and support doing the right thing.
Is it true that you were in the insurance business and some of the insurance companies are starting to look at this and the impacts? Have you any insight into that, given your background in the
insurance? I don't. We've been out of the casualty business for now about 5 years. Okay. So, again, that's not something that I think about as it relates to a particular industry, but I think about it as to what is really important from the point of view of global warming, greenhouse gases, pollution, and quality of life, because that's very important to the people that we live with and to our grandkids and grandkids' grandkids.
Terrific. Our thanks to Sandy Weill, recently retired chairman of Citigroup, board chair of Carnegie Hall, and author of The Real Deal, My Life in Business and Philanthropy. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Oh. Good.